a condition of the approval. That way they can move forward. They don't need to come back to the planning board itself. And we are assured that it is in good hands with our consultant.
Well, we would need an acoustical consultant. You know, I don't think that that's very specific. So we don't have one.
Aaron, are you on the meeting, Aaron? Where I don't see Aaron.
I saw his name, but I don't know that Aaron's an acoustical, you know, interview.
Yeah. I don't.
But he was here. I'm pretty sure I saw his name.
Yeah, no, he's here. I don't know if he can hear us.
If I could chime in, I'm also happy to share the proposal, and the measures in it, I think, are pretty, I'm not an engineer, obviously, perhaps none of us on either call, but it all seems pretty, but it seems like work that would fall in the purview of, you know, whoever the board sees fit to review it, but it's not particularly complex, and, you know, once again, the kind of other safeguard kind of thing we have in place is that basically everything that we would do would ensure that we're in compliance of the noise ordinance that exists. So it's, that's sort of like the safeguard, is that whatever gets designed will achieve. The point is that, you know, it achieves the code that's already set forth by the city. So that was my only other thought.
Well, I just guess I'm a bit confused because if there's a condition, again, right now we don't have an acoustical engineer on our end, Patrick, and therefore we will not ever know what that is. I mean, there were some pretty severe comments from the public about the sound, and this is, you know, it's very tricky in Hudson because of all the echoing and the way sound travels here. The other thing that we talked about last meeting was also in the idea of putting some end times on when, you know, live sound needs to cease. And we never skip subjects, and we never really discuss that in depth. The idea of, instead of, I don't know what time you can have live music out in Hudson, but let's just say it's 11, live music, loud sound, I don't mean live band, but amplified sound in Hudson. Let's just say that it's supposed to end at 11. Instead, it ends at 10 or 9 or something like that. This is a neighborhood. I just want my board members and the public to realize that this is, more than anything, a real neighborhood.
Residential.
Pardon?
Residential, mostly.
Yes. Yes, residential neighborhood, yeah.
And I think we have Aaron with us, and, you know, I think that, Laura, you've succinctly expressed the concern from our last meeting. Aaron, were you able to hear Sean's description of his work with the consultants, and can you imagine how a mechanism might work that could involve an external review of those mitigation measures?
Yeah, certainly. Can you hear me, members of the board?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. So I think, Larry, what you and I talked about earlier this afternoon in anticipation of the meeting was perhaps relying on your noise ordinance for this proposal. Your noise ordinance limits there needs to be an objective way to review the project. So echoing and things of that nature are harder to nail down. However, your ordinance defines essentially nuisance sound and defines the the more objective way of measuring it, which is using decibels at the property line. And so currently your code limits the amount of noise from a commercial establishment between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. That would be the objective measurement of this. I would say that if during the operation, as the applicant has suggested, if during the operations there becomes a problem with sound, they would, you know, essentially not operate outdoors until they remedy it. But as far as, you know, what this acoustic, there needs to be a goal for the acoustical engineer. What is it they need to achieve? Okay. And generally that would be a sound level at a property line, which again, they can achieve simply by turning the volume down.
Right. I think, you know, the difficulty is between, you know, you go into restaurants and they have acoustical panels on the ceiling and sound baffling and soft fabrics added to banquettes, all of which serve to reduce the ambient noise in the restaurant. And there probably isn't someone with a sound meter measuring that. It's a much more subjective experience of the thing. But the result is that the atmosphere and environment is made more pleasing. And, you know, I think between the kind of systems that have no measurability and the hard measurability of decibels at the property line, you know, I'd like to see if we can't come up with some mechanism that allows us to ensure that there is appropriate acoustical mitigation measures put in place by the applicant that may not necessarily be tied to a specific metric. And I don't know, you know, I don't know how we might do that. I hear Aaron's reservations about you know, if you establish it as a condition in the project to be evaluated by someone external, they're going to want a number to check to see whether they can reach that number. And then that becomes the number in the code because we can't exceed that. And then we're winding up with nothing again because we already have the code. So, Patrick, I wonder if there's a way that you can imagine that we essentially require the applicant to hire the acoustical consultant that they of their choosing to develop mitigation measures and have those things externally reviewed, even if we cannot actually apply a data metric to the review. And, you know, how do we do that without it being arbitrary and capricious? I don't really know. I think it's a lot of that comes down to how we, you know, if indeed we have a condition, how we word that.
Well, I think you and Aaron kind of got to the crux of it, which is the consultant would have to review it based on some sort of standard. And it seems to me like the most obvious way to go about it would be for the applicant to have to demonstrate that there would be compliance with the noise ordinance via this plan that it's coming up with. And we would have a consultant review that in order to state whether or not this seems like a feasible plan that actually will ensure that those impacts are mitigated.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'm Brandy Nelson. I'm the civil engineer working with Pocketbook Factory. And we actually recommended Mr. Khan at Acoustical Distinctions, having worked with him on a number of other outdoor venues that were going to have music. His credentials and qualifications are very good, very strong. And, you know, what he will do in our conversation with him, he's digesting the city's noise ordinance, but he's working backwards from that noise ordinance. So, you know, I think Sean has already mentioned that issues of hours of operation, you know, those are clearly defined. And if those need to be part of a condition, I think that's an easy thing, you know, similar to what Patrick said, rely on the ordinance. But he'll be working backwards to develop a performance specification for compliance. And I think that would be available to be reviewed by Aaron for consistency with the noise ordinance. But, you know, we're relying on his specific expertise with sound generation and the mitigation measures that need to be in place. And some of that is equipment specification. And some of it, as Sean said, might be outdoor treatments. But he is, you know, acutely aware of the noise ordinance and working within the guidelines of that ordinance.
Well, I guess I still don't know where we are. I mean, I just want to repeat, remind everybody that two times, I believe, there were events at the Pocketbook Factory that put out sound that was deafening to the neighbors. And that was before, you know, we approved this application. So I just want to make sure that, I mean, in other words, if the acoustical designer or engineer does this comes up with a plan, and we've already given approval to the Pocketbook Factory, we really don't have a way to approve whatever the design is. We won't know what the specifics are. In other words, this is not going to happen, 20 trees, then that will cut the levels to X amount. We won't even know that stuff. We're just approving something that we don't really know. And I do want to, again, and thank you, Brandy, for that. I do want to consider, some time limitations on when amplified sound can stop outside. That actually would make me feel very good.
Yeah, Laura, I completely hear that. And I think that, you know, I sort of like Brandy's notion of establishing performance criteria that are in the code and having the acoustical designer work towards the meeting of that thing. I think a lot of it is going to depend on how Patrick guides us through the language of a resolution, but we're not really there yet. I think that, you know, why don't we, if there's not other questions from the board or other contributions from the applicant, why don't we open it up to public commentary? And then after we've taken in the public commentary, we can look at the specifics of a possible resolution and what language might actually be able to get us to the point where we as a board are comfortable with the stipulations enough that we can move forward and still have a level, you know, the applicant gets to know that they have approval and we get to know that we have a level of control. I don't know that we're going to get there, but I think that we are in a public hearing, and if the board doesn't have additional comments or questions for Roland before we refer to Sean, before we open it up to the public, I think that we should do that.
Okay, I agree. Good.
Or do we have any other questions for Sean and the design team before we open it up to the public hearing? Okay. Are there members of the public who wish to speak to the application before the board right now? I don't.
Chair, as a formality, we should have a motion to open.
Oh, thank you. Was that you, Patrick, that told me that?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Patrick. May I have a motion to open the public hearing?
I move.
That was Laura. Jean, you seconded? Great. Okay, are there any members of the public who wish to speak? I don't see any little hands on my screens. Yeah, curious. Okay, we don't seem to have anyone who wishes to weigh in. I would imagine that after perhaps months of public input, we have heard from folks who need to speak. Board members, before I turn it over to Patrick, do we have additional thoughts or comments?
I have a thought or comment, or maybe it's a question to, maybe this is a Craig Haig question, like, what's the enforcement mechanism? Is it literally someone there with a sound meter and demonstrating that they're violating X, Y, or Z condition or city code, and it's reported to Craig, and then Craig comes out and does what? I guess I'm thinking about this in the sense of, Laura's point's an excellent one, in that we're going to be moving ahead and potentially approving something that we have no real control over. But I think it makes sense for us to understand that whatever punitive, if that's the right word, whatever steps the city takes to make sure that the code is met, that we and the applicant understand what those measures are.
Yeah, and it's not, I mean, that's a great question, because, you know, the noise issue is not apt to happen at 4 p.m. on a Thursday. It's going to happen at 10:45 p.m. on a Friday, when the only parties that will be reachable by the general public will be the police. And
that is what happens, I believe.
Yeah. Just you need a noise complaint, right?
I believe. And I think they come out with a sound meter. I believe that, I mean, probably Andy knows this better than any of us, but I think they come out with a sound meter to the person that's lodged a complaint, and they do a sound test there. But I might be wrong about that.
Yeah, I mean, just briefly, what I would say is a couple of things. I mean, one thing is the city of Hudson does have, unlike a lot of jurisdictions, it does have a noise ordinance, which is a good thing. So if we're looking at a situation where at 11:15 there's all this loud music taking place, you know, whether that's a condition that the planning board puts on or it's in the code, which it is, that's going to provide a basis in and of itself that there is an activity right now that is happening that is outside the letter of the Hudson code. That's number one. Number two, looking at it from the reverse, I mean, if there was some sort of low level noise that, you know, was out there, you know, during the day, you know, those types of noises are also picked up within your code, and there's probably not going to be a complaint because they're going to meet them. So I understand what you're saying, Laura, and you're definitely doing your job as a planning board member to say, okay, we have this use. It isn't a GCT zone. It is a permitted use, but we have to recognize that there are people nearby. What does our code say about it? What sort of assurance are we going to get from the applicant's expert that they're going to meet those code provisions? And specifically within that, are there mitigating measures that they're going to put in place that they can put in place to address those things? And those attenuating measures would be something that your engineer could look at and could say, yes, number one, they're meeting the code. It's a really good backstop. I mean, unlike some codes, you look at those provisions, they're pretty specific. You know, any noise after a certain time is deemed unreasonable. You don't need a meter. You're not supposed to have it. So you have that backstop. Then on top of it, going to the points that Larry and Clark have made, okay, notwithstanding that hard backstop, we as a planning board want to have the sound acoustical expert provide information about attenuation, so that unlike the meet and greet that occurred that we've talked about, where it was simply people in a vacant lot using a single amplified speaker to kind of see the project. Clearly it was loud, but that is not, you know, the site doesn't look the way it's going to look. The material, the amplification that's going to be used isn't going to be the same. And what you would have as a board and what your engineer would look at would be a specific plan, as Brandy talked about, with the equipment and with any sort of outdoor attenuation, so that you basically have both of those two things. And that then goes in the file, and I apologize this is so long, but it goes in the file, and then that's there so that, wait a minute, there's a condition that they're supposed to have live music till this point. There's also a code provision that says the same thing. They're outside of it. They're in violation. They're charged. I mean, it's like any sort of enforcement. You know, even if you put, you know, 3 p.m. is the sound barrier, what happens if somebody does it at 5? It's the same thing. But that's why you have a code, so that everybody, A, is treated fairly, but also that there's an objective standard for the code enforcement officer and the police.
Thank you, Eddie. I just want to also point out that in the past where we've had, this as something to deal with, we were able to see the report from the sound engineer before we approved the application. And that's Andy, I think that this is where this is a little strange. I also want to point out that Sean and everybody at the Pocketbook Factory has really emphasized, how much they want to involve and be the community, the residents that live there in the community, to be a part of that, to have them be a part of this. And I would think that being sure that the sound ended at a decent hour for people that get up in the morning and go to work every day, and also would like to enjoy their weekends at, too. I would think that would be part of, I would think that they would consider, make special considerations for those very people that all through this application process, they have talked about, which are the residents that live in that community.
Yeah, I think, why don't we get into the specifics of the language? That might really help us clarify whether we're able to get to a point of agreement amongst ourselves about how we might proceed here. Patrick, you have a draft resolution. Do you want to share screen and allow us to review that together?
I will do so right now.
I would ask the members of the public, those who are not on the board, to allow us to deliberate. Shaheen, if you could mute everyone who's not one of us, that would be wonderful.
Sorry, do we need to close the public hearing, or can we just do this without closing the public hearing?
Oh, yeah, we should close. Patrick, should we close the public hearing?
We could have this discussion before or after. But if we would like to just make it clear that this is time for just the planning board to speak amongst themselves, then we can close the public hearing.
Yeah, let's do that. I can't say that. Board, do I have a motion to close the public hearing?
So moved.
Thank you, John. I'll second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
Aye.
Thank you.
Nay. Whichever.
Patrick, you get that?
Yes. Our office had been asked to draft a potential resolution to grant site plan approval for the Pocketbook Factory. I believe it's being shared right now. Would you like to focus on the conditions, or do you want to go through each paragraph?
Each paragraph.
Yeah, I think we need a quick review of the terms, sure. Patrick. That'll really help.
Sure. So the first paragraph is summarizing the situation. The applicant, PBF Hudson LLC, has applied for site plan approval to convert an existing vacant factory/warehouse into a mixed-use development, including a 40-room hotel with spa, lounge, and cafe, garden room, restaurant, and bar, retail office, and gallery space with a publicly accessible interior courtyard, parens the project, on property located at 549 Washington Street, identified as tax parcel number 110.45-3-74.100. The property in the city of Hudson in the general commercial transitional GCT zoning district. The project is depicted on a specific site plan. I will move past reciting all of the pages of the site plan. It is what's been reviewed at length before this board. Pursuant to sections 325-16A and 325-35 of the zoning law and determination of your code enforcement officer, the project is permitted, subject to site plan approval in that district. Earlier, June 9th, 2021, the planning board referred the application materials to the County Department of Planning and Development for their review, under 239M of the General Municipal Law.
Can I stop you here? Is that a copy-paste error? Do you mean to say Dutchess County?
That is a copy-paste error. So that is clearly the Columbia County Department of Planning and Development. They responded on July 20th, 2021, that this project is a matter of local concern. On October 14th, your board determined that the project would not have a significant adverse environmental impact under SEAKER, and that ended the environmental review. The public hearing was first opened on June 8th. this is assuming it closes this evening permanently, it would have closed November 9th. During that time, all those who wish to speak were heard. And finally, we note that all of these meetings were held in accordance with Executive Order 202.1 and the subsequent extensions, which allow these open meetings to happen online. I will also add that the laws of, I believe it's Chapter 417 of the laws of 2021 allow this as well. And that was the provision enacted by the new governor. So based on that, if the planning board wanted to make a decision, we've drafted language saying that now, therefore, be it resolved that the planning board hereby grants site plan approval to the project as shown on the site plan set recited above, and authorizes the chairperson or his authorized designee to sign the plat or the site plan set after compliance with the following conditions. One, payment of all fees in escrow. This is a fairly standard condition. Two, approval by the planning board attorney of a declaration of easement granting public access to open space on the property as indicated on the site plan set for purposes of passive recreation during daylight hours, along with an undertaking from the applicant's attorney to record the declaration as soon as the site plan set is signed. Now, would you like to discuss this condition by itself, or would you like to go through the rest of the conditions and then come back to number two?
I think that since there might be issues regarding all the subsequent ones, maybe we take them one at a time.
Fair enough. So the purpose of this condition is to memorialize and make it efficient for the city to enforce the fact that the applicant is offering this public space on the property. I believe the applicant may have comments on the proposed language here. If you would like to allow the applicant's attorney to participate, that is up to you.
Patrick, can you summarize the attorney's concerns so we keep our discussion tight?
Sure. Andy, I believe your concerns were that you would rather have language along the lines of the following. The applicant shall maintain the open space area at the rear of the building for public use and passive recreation during daylight hours, except in those limited instances where the open space area is utilized for a private event. The difference between that language and the condition here is that we have proposed that they have a declaration of easement that would then be recorded with the county. That would be a binding document that would presumably grant the city a explicit enforcement right to make sure that this public act space is indeed kept open. Whereas the applicant's language, I believe, makes it a lot more difficult for the city to enforce that provision.
Is there any possible way to do both? Because the way it's written is good, and I think that we want to be able to be enforce it, to have it enforced. On the other hand, I mean, I don't, you know, nobody knows how many times it's going to be a private event, but, you know, is there any way they could also have a private event?
Certainly. The language of the declaration of the easement could say that this space is only made available in particular circumstances at particular times. And if the board, and if we wanted to allow that space to be closed off to the public during certain events, I think that is a reasonable accommodation.
But then we lose that, we lose the, you had said that this gives us, the way it's written, it gives us what? It gives us the possibility.
It makes it easier to enforce.
Okay. So how do we make it easier to enforce, like you had described, and still give them the opportunity to, hey, Sean or anybody, is there no area that can be open to the public, even if you have, isn't there some place that could be open to the public, even if you have an event?
Yeah, I, this is Andy. I don't want to speak, I don't want to cut off Patrick until you're ready. I just want to be able to express our concerns on each of the points as we go through it. If this is an appropriate time, I will.
Sure, Andy.
Okay. All right. I just want to be sure. Our concern are a couple of things. You know, number one, we were surprised when we saw this declaration of an easement, because it's not something that we ever, you know, offered or said that we would do. The concern we have are a couple of things. Number one, this sort of easement would run with the land. So in the future, if there was some other use there, this is now filed with the Columbia County Clerk's Office and is like any easement, it's running with the land. Whereas if in the future this building changed and the usage changed, if we had it as a condition of this approval and a new use was coming in, that new owner would have to come back to the planning board and they'd have to go through the entire process again like we did and have conditions put in place. In this particular instance, we feel that it is private property. We've always been clear that we want to have it open to the public. We're willing to have it be a condition. It is enforceable like any other condition you put on other projects. When you regulate use at any commercial establishment throughout the city, you put a condition on them, and we're ready to have that condition. That's a lot different than creating a property right. And that's what's being proposed here. And so I just want to be clear. It's not that we're walking away from doing what we said we would do. Patrick did read it. I did create language that I sent to him in a separate document that you could look at. We're not walking away from it. But to us, filing a property right is a lot different than having a condition. And I think enforceability exists either way. If we suddenly lock all this and don't let anybody in, you can revoke our site plan. We're not allowed to do that. So those are our concerns.
If I could comment, it sort of cuts to the core of the concern the board raised from the beginning, which was very much how do we define a public space? We greatly appreciate your, Pocketbook Factor's effort to revitalize this very important building in the city of Hudson. But I believe, maybe I took charge or maybe took a little bit of lead in attempting to press the applicant in defining specifically what that meant to say it was public space. And clearly, what this language now says is you have agreed that this is public space. And we heard very much early on that this was going to be public space. And again, I trust and respect your view, Andy, that you guys aren't necessarily backpedaling, but this is really the crux of the matter. Like, what does it mean to be a public space? And clearly, if it is a public space, this language we have now seems to work in my mind.
And that's a very interesting point, Clark, because you did press the applicant on that. The landscape architect for the project gave a series of case studies, many of them in New York City that operate under New York City's public plaza laws, which I believe actually are easemented, right? That
yes,
public has a right to use the land. And I think what's interesting about an easement, it also does, it goes with the land. Andy's absolutely right, but it also does protect the property owner from any common law claims of open space, right? I mean, at Harvard, they lock the gates to Harvard Yard once a year so that they assert private property dominion over the land, and the city of Cambridge can't claim by common law that because the public has been allowed unimpeded access to the property, that it's public land. Right. And the nice thing about an easement is it clearly establishes who the property owner is and gives the public a marginal use of that land as indicated in the easement. So it doesn't just take away from the property owner. It also asserts the boundaries of that open space.
Right. I mean, just to be heard, what we've always said is that we would grant public access. We never said we were going to create this as a public park. We were going to provide public access to our private property, and we're not walking away from that in any way, shape, or form. But the placement of an easement, and again, until 2 hours ago I never saw this, the placement of an easement, that is basically, that's granting essentially a property interest to the city without the city paying for it. It's a taking. We never offered an easement, And I mean, the resolution itself, when we look at it, it talks about public access to open space. We are, again, we're not changing that. We continue to offer that. And the concern was, we did have a lot of discussion. The concern the board had, they didn't want too many rules because they didn't want to impair. They wanted people to have a place where they could go. And we certainly continue that. But there's a distinction between that and placing an easement on private property. And that's our concern.
Chair, may I ask the question of either of the attorneys to maybe help direct this conversation?
Yeah, sure.
I've run into this in the past. When you're dealing with property rights, typically that authority rests with a city council or mayor or the executive of the legislative branch of the city. So I don't know, is this something that the Planning Commission could do, or does the condition have to be that the city body responsible for property dealings?
I think our attorney wouldn't do it if it wasn't something we could do. But Patrick?
Yeah, in this situation, the city common council would eventually sign off on whatever easement would be granted. And I'd also just like to state that public access easements are often given for these types of projects where it is understood that the public is meant to have access to these types of spaces. And in this type of situation, I think having a separate document is also very useful, because we've been trying to nail down what exactly this public use is and where it would be. And having just a sentence as a condition in your resolution is enforceable. However, there's ambiguity there that has not been fully fleshed out so far. And I might not feel comfortable recommending you approve a condition that just says for public use and passive recreation when we're not entirely sure what that would be. Whereas if we have an easement, that can be very clearly fleshed out, this right to exclude during non-daylight hours and during special events can be made very clear. Andy, I'm sure you have thoughts.
Well, before we get Andy's thoughts, Patrick, can I just follow up on a question relative to Andy's point? You know, an easement goes with the land. What if, say, the hotel sells the property to a different private developer who wants to create low-income senior housing, and they have concerns about the public encroaching on the safety of the seniors who are living there, but there is this easement? What happens in that scenario?
Well, are you talking about there being a change in use in that situation?
Yes.
Okay. They would come back to the planning board for a new or amended site plan approval, as Andy alluded to. And in that situation, I believe that the easement would be readdressed by the planning board and by the city. And if it was no longer necessary, or was no longer serving any purpose, I believe that the city would reevaluate that at that time. Moreover, if the project is eventually changed, it could be that that the public would no longer have a desire or need to access this space. Clark, were you about to say something?
Oh, sorry. I guess I had a thought, which was, it's useful to understand what that process would be to sort of revoke the easement, but it seems, not that it's irrelevant, but I think it's sort of like cross that bridge when we get to it. It's very important to understand what that is, but that could be decades down the road or never. And I feel like we should address the issue at hand, which is the application. You know, again, we're passionate out here what this means to have a public space. And I think we should address the immediate issue now. And again, they're going to put many millions of dollars into this building. I doubt that this issue is going to arise anytime soon. And I think that we should make sure that this board is comfortable with the definition of what that access means. So I not that this is irrelevant, but I think it's not our key concern right now.
Well, relative to that, Patrick, I've got a question about procedure. Do you, I mean, you know what we're facing in the next other four bullet points, as well as the bullet point that doesn't exist yet on acoustics, do you think it behooves us to go through all of the conditions and then vote up or down on the entire resolution? Or do you think it's imperative that we address each one of these matters and get a sense of the board on the resolutions, on the conditions as we move through them?
Well, in any case, the board is going to have to review the conditions individually.
Right.
I think that in a situation like this, it's unfortunately going to require a significant bit of discussion for each and every one. If you think that it might be better to acknowledge that we've had a discussion on this and table it for the time being for the sake of moving forward, that's up to the planning board.
Can I make a suggestion?
Sure.
Thinking about public spaces in New York City, which I'm familiar with, and Bryant Park comes up, and obviously it's a different beast because it's a big public space, but it's a public space that had some controversy relative to it being used by public entities, including an annual or fashion show. So I know there are there are public spaces with bylaws or whatever, you know, that have maybe it amends the notion that this is just 100% public space and that there are events that happen here that are very private. And I'm wondering if that model it would be useful here, where it's the, I'm just throwing this out there as an idea, the easement is granted, but the applicant or the owner has X number of times per year. I know the applicant has also said, we're not doing big events and we're not regularly and we're not an event space. So they have clearly stated that there's not going to be many of these. Maybe the condition says, yes, the easement is granted, but per Bryant Park example, there are private events that happen in this public space, and we can define what those might be. Again, maybe it's a half dozen times a year, maybe it's 10 times a year, and the owner of the property has right to this easement or this space, which has a public easement.
Patrick said that was possible in the easement. Patrick had already, right, Patrick?
I believe so. Also, I was refraining from bringing this up because it is a different discussion that I believe Andy and I would have to have outside of this meeting. But there are instruments that could limit this public right to a specific time or to the specific use, such that in the future, if the use did change, the public access right would be eliminated.
And would that, Patrick, happen in the drafting of the declaration of easement?
It would be written into the instrument itself.
And does the board review that instrument at some point, or is that a private negotiation that's then taken to the common council for review?
Well, it can go a variety of ways. The way we have the language drafted at the moment is that the board wants to ensure that there is public access to open space on the property. And in order to do so, it has kind of delegated ultimate approval authority over to its council. So its attorney would then receive a proposed easement from the applicant. We would review it, go back and forth, and make sure that its terms meet the language that the resolution intended it to meet.
And just so I can be clear, we don't have a problem having those conditions spelled out and having them in writing. And if there's an enforcement mechanism that you want to have incorporated in that, I mean, that's something that we would need to do with the planning board's attorney. You know, our concern is, you know, creating this property right and filing it. And it just doesn't seem necessary here in the sense that we can provide for the public access that we've talked about. We can provide for the parameters that we've talked about in terms of hour of operation. And we can talk about specifically what happens if we fail to do that and get this planning board and its attorney to approve that and not go through, you know, really the granting of a property right to the common council. Cause that's, you know, not something that we've talked about in the last 6 months. Public access to the site, absolutely. Written agreement, spelling it out, absolutely. You want to have penalties if we don't do it. We're fully comfortable that we're going to do this. Fine. But it is a bit unprecedented to have an easement such as this on private property, particularly where the applicant had no legal obligation to do that. And again, isn't running from it, but is now, you know, being told they have to give up a property right. And so that's our concern. Having something in writing is not a concern. It's really this, the filing mechanism and having it be essentially an easement on the real property that really doesn't go away. I mean, I know the board may not care about it, but that private property owner does, because if the city later decides, no, you don't want to get rid of it. In Larry's example, we have no way to get rid of it. And that's a problem. I mean, it's a problem for us.
I could just explain that might be, you know, the way it's languaged. The thing is this, as Patrick has mentioned, and I think maybe it was Clark, we really never, part of the selling point of the pocketbook family, the pocketbook factory, has been this idea of the public's open public space. And it's something that Sean and the other people involved have talked about from day one, but yet it, and with much enthusiasm, and not just to the board, but to the public.
Sure.
But yet it really truly has not been defined. And, so for us to come up with a condition, it's pretty difficult, Andy, because we really don't know what we're, you know, we don't really know what the plan is for the public space. And I just want to repeat that this is a neighborhood, you know, it's a residential neighborhood. It's a little different than some of the other applications. And it's a hotel, you know, where people aren't going to be living here. They're coming, they're going, you know, they might come back because they like Hudson, they might not. They're not invested here, but the people that live in that area are. And I think that's one of the reasons why Sean so wonderfully is said that this, you know, this is a, you know, an open, a public access is one of the major things that they're doing.
But
we do not really, it's not something that has been emphasized in any planned way to us. And, I don't know how we go forward with that. I wouldn't even know how we begin to put conditions on something that we don't have a plan. You know, we don't have a plan. We haven't heard what the plan is.
But yeah, Laura, may I actually respond to that?
Yeah.
And I mean, thanks for recognizing that it is important to us and that we've been consistent in our desire to, you know, rehabilitate the entire site and make it available to the public and really bring back something that has been gated and closed off for 40 years, because that is the scenario. And really the contrast in what we're doing is, you know, investing an incredible amount of money in the restoration of this building and the landscape around it. And as Andy said, we are willing to commit to operating in a way where we can set conditions with the planning board. And, you know, I think we have actually created a pretty in-depth plan with our landscape architects, Wagner Hodgson. And we've presented that over the course of 7 months with you guys. So you've seen planting.
Right, Sean, but the reality is that this is, Sean, this is now the point at which we have to determine what that actually means legally. Right. And kumbaya pictures are different than the words of the law. But we've already been on this about an hour. We still have four more conditions to review. I propose that we table this conversation, understanding our reservations, I think our collective reservations, and then see how far we get in terms of whether we're able to reach some level of agreement across the bulk of these conditions.
Yeah. And Larry, just really quickly, just to be clear, what we've always said is public access. We want to have it open, passive recreation. Remember, where people can go and enjoy the space and can just be. We're not going to put overly stringent rules on what they can do there. And I understand the board's concern. You want something in writing to make sure we do what we said. we will do that. The issue is hearing now that that's suddenly illegal being approved by the county council. That's it. Okay.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you. Patrick, can you take us to the number three?
Sure. Next one, speaking of easements. Approval by the planning board attorney of an easement or agreement granting the applicant use of off-site parking facilities sufficient to accommodate increased demand in parking during special events held at the property, along with an undertaking from the applicant's attorney to record the easement or agreement as soon as the site plan set is signed. Now, I spoke with Andy about potential conditions, and he also provided a comment on this, stating that he would rather the language say something along the lines of the applicant shall provide off-site parking facilities and a shuttle to bring guests from the site for any private event hosting more than 75 people. So it's setting a actual numerical threshold. It would also have the applicant file proof of having said off-site parking facilities in the form of a written lease or other written agreement to be filed with the City of Hudson Code Enforcement Officer. And that would have to be filed at least 10 days prior to any private event hosting more than 75 people.
Patrick, what's your recommendation on that?
So in this one, we acknowledge that trying to arrange for an easement over separate property for the use of parking that would run with the land and basically keep going throughout the life of the property might be a bit much to ask of the applicant in this situation. So that's why I included the language or agreement granting the applicant use of offsite parking facilities. Essentially, we just want to ensure that in the event that they have these events, that we know where the cars are going to go, and we want to have proof that they've made arrangements for this in advance. So
can we just strike the words? What would happen if we took out easement or and just said approval by the planning board attorney of an agreement granting the applicant, and then later on that, to record the agreement? Isn't that essentially sure.
That would most likely address a number of Andy's concerns, I'm sure. And in that situation, I think that the planning board could still feel comfortable knowing that the applicant needs to arrange for these parking facilities in advance, and we will be making sure that for these special events, they won't overwhelm the area. So it could be something along the lines of
what?
And then in that case, an agreement most likely would not be recorded, not with the county anyway, but we would require that the agreement be filed with the Office of Planning Board Secretary and the Code Enforcement Official.
So you'd also strike the second time that appears, right? Record the
last sentence. That. Yeah.
Or what's your opinions about this?
Are you asking me or the remainder of the board members?
The board members.
I have a question. He said 75 people. Are we not going to honor that, or we're going to put our own number in?
Well, this language doesn't have Andy's number in there. Do you
Are we not going to put a number in there, honor the 75, or do we have our own number? Why 75? I mean...
That number came because that's the figure that's used for any mass gathering permit in the city.
Okay.
And I think we talked about that previously. And the reason why we suggested that language is because I believe Sean talked about it. I mean, they currently don't plan on having any of those large events. And what they pledge to do is that should they get to a point where they have a one-off or you know, they have something along those lines, that they will fulfill that pledge to provide proof that they have, a written lease agreement or other agreement to shuttle people to and from the site. I did add that language too. They'll bring them in, they'll take them out. you know, we thought, again, to make sure that it was clear, that it would be filed with the code enforcement officer. I mean, if you want language that says, you know, with the approval of the city attorney, obviously that's fine as well. But then this just allows them to, if they're going to do it, put it in place. Because otherwise, you know, having an easement is pretty difficult.
And I'd like to acknowledge that, speaking of parking, Lindsay might have something to offer.
Well, I'd like to offer that even though it's allowed to be 75 in that area, I guess my question is, if even if it was 50 people,
it'd be a lot.
Mm-hmm. It would be a lot. So, because we already have a parking issue there. So, I don't know, 75 seems like it's a not, you know, that's too many.
Too high, you mean?
Too high.
Yeah. Lindsay's here with us now. Lindsay, can you counsel us here?
Yeah, and hopefully you can hear me. I just don't have video tonight.
Oh, we can.
Yeah. All right. My only concern, and I know the expectation is events are going to be limited. My only concern would be events that run past midnight. That's when alternate side parking is in effect and when parking is significantly constrained. So I might offer to the board a suggestion of altering that number to be lower, a lower threshold, if the event is going to run past midnight.
Yeah, that's so a really good point.
What would be the lower number, Lindsay?
I'd have to go back to the actual numbers to define like what that parking capacity might be. You know, we're at the 85% threshold. Events are going to be rare. You know, perhaps roughly half the number, you know, 40, 50, something like that.
That would be 40, 41.
It would be only if the event runs past midnight.
Why midnight? People park their cars before midnight, don't they?
But at midnight. Yeah, sorry.
You can go ahead, Larry.
At midnight, the parking crunch happens, right? Because you can park on both sides of the street before midnight, and then all of a sudden at midnight, we lose half our spaces.
It says that? The sign says at midnight? Or does it say 11 p.m.?
It's midnight.
Oh, it's midnight.
Midnight to 8 a.m.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, I would agree to a lower number.
I think 40.
41.
41.
Yeah, they got parking spaces for 40.
For events going beyond midnight.
Yeah.
And then Patrick, I think we should add what Andy had said about, busing.
Coming and going.
And out, coming and going, yeah.
Definitely, I agree.
It would sure be nice if the public could be made aware beforehand that this is going to be happening. Is there any way that can be done?
I would envision, Laura, because again, these are going to be rare events if they happen at all, that would be part of the process, that anyone who received an invite would be told, meet at this location for a shuttle that'll take you to and from.
Yep. Right, but the people that live in the area, Andy, be made aware that, you know, you might have some parking issues, or I don't know.
Well, hopefully they won't, because we'll be shuttling people, right? So that should work.
Oh, I'm sorry. Put more than 40. So that means 41. Okay.
You're so funny.
Well, I have to make it for the simple people like me.
All right, let's continue and get a sense of the whole picture before we go back to this language.
Sure.
Patrick, can you do this number four?
Yes, moving on to number four, I think this is a fairly straightforward one. Applicant shall purchase 40 parking permits from the City of Hudson for guests and employees. Upon speaking with Andy, he wanted to add language that they would purchase 40 parking permits on an annual basis to reflect that they'd have to re-up each year. He also wanted to add the following sentence. In the event applicant secures fixed parking spaces totaling at least 40 spaces, applicant shall not be required to purchase parking permits from the City of Hudson. Essentially, if they don't need the parking permits anymore, then they don't need to get the parking permits.
But they find a
permit. I think it's a reasonable request.
Sounds good to me.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So if they are able to purchase a parking lot or make a parking lot, then that has at least 40 car spaces, they don't need the permits anymore. That's fair.
What? So keep buying spaces every year.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. Number three is confusing, so I know you're going to change that. So
yeah, we're going to go back up to it.
Oh, yeah, we're going to clean that up.
Yes.
All right. Should we move on to number five?
Please, let's.
Before we go back, can we go back to that one with the parking spaces?
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
The way I understand it, the city issues parking permits for parking tickets. The only place they rent spaces out and get a permit for is the Amtrak parking lot. In the municipal lots, it's only for the event of getting parking tickets, that if you have a permit, you don't get a parking meter violation ticket.
Gene, we had 620 Union Street, we had them get permits in the city lot. And they had talked to Tracy, and she seemed to have no problem with that. And I would assume this would be the same kind of thing, where they actually got, I don't know what they'd be, hanger cards to put on somebody's mirror or something like that, to show that there's a permit for a parking space in this lot. There was no mention of tickets or anything like that when we were doing the write-up for that.
Okay.
And I don't know, you're coming at it from, the police department angle. You might know something I don't, so.
Yeah, that's the way I understood it, that the only rented space is for the Amtrak parking lot, but the municipal parking lots, the permits are issued for freedom of a ticket, so to speak. And I had asked Tracy that like a couple of weeks ago.
Uh-huh.
And she said it was for parking tickets, not to reserve a space.
Well, I don't think we expected when we did it with 620 Union Street that it would reserve a specific space. It would just be a thing where, they would have the ability to give their guests a permit to park in a city lot.
Basically, prepaying the meter with the permit.
Basically, yeah.
That's our understanding. If we're wrong about that, then we've been talking about projects for months in the wrong way.
I think that's right, and I think Gene's right in the sense that it's important to make it clear, like, we'll have these permits, but that doesn't mean for city residents that we're blocking off 40 spaces in the park. Like, it's a fluid situation, so
right.
But we'll have a permit where they can go there, but they don't. The Pocketbook Factory does not own a parking space,
right?
And what we did confirm is that there, and your traffic consultant did likewise, there are enough open spaces so that we could purchase these permits, and there's still other spaces available for members of the public.
Right.
Can I ask a question? Would that include parking at meters on the street also, that permit?
No, I think it's just in the lots.
Just the lots. Yeah.
I guess, but Andy, are you saying, in other words, even though there is on-street parking, is it the plan to use up these permits that you have, or wait until there's no more parking on the street and one of the customers says, geez, there's no place to park, and then give them a permit? I don't get it. How's that going to be managed?
Yeah, no, under the parking study that we did, we would be providing that to patrons of the hotel space so that they would have a fixed place to go and have a parking space, taking them off the street.
Okay.
Yep. That's every room, right?
Yeah.
Every room.
Yeah,
and additionally, including messaging when anyone would confirm a hotel room that, here's the parking procedure and that we have permits available and here's the location of that lot.
And I can tell you, I've been to certain cities where that's exactly what happens. When you go and check in, they immediately give you a voucher so that you can go and utilize a municipal space.
you know.
So you drop your stuff and you go park.
Sometimes there's even a valet that does it for you. All right, let's do number five. Patrick, can you take us to number five?
Gladly. Number five, applicant shall operate a shuttle between the project and the Hudson train station for hotel guests and staff. Now, this condition has kind of been pushed up into number three. And Andy had suggested that the condition be used instead to address shuttling for construction workers. Now, it really depends on what issues the planning board is trying to address by requiring the shuttle. I think in this case, we would be covering guests going to and from the other parking facilities. Andy is suggesting having a shuttle for construction workers during construction. I guess the only other question is whether or not the planning board also wants to have a shuttle operating throughout the project's operation. Between the project and the train station.
Wouldn't the construction workers use the same 40 permits that are in number four?
Yeah, no, and if I could, if I can explain, because I thought maybe there was some confusion, maybe there wasn't, but you know what we had represented to the board during the process was that during construction, we had secured an offsite location, if you recall, where we would be bringing the workers in on a daily basis. When they're working on the site, so that there's a minimal, impairment to the neighbors. So they're literally, there's not a lot of obstruction. And I just didn't see that anywhere in the condition. So the idea was, if you recall, they were going to be bussing in those workers. They would work the day and then they would bus them out. And that wasn't contained anywhere within the conditions. With regard to, the shuttle, I think as Patrick said, we feel like the parking permits have addressed that, number one. And number two, somebody getting off the train, I mean, they can, they can certainly take an Uber to come up, they're not going to have a car. So we've addressed the issue with those that do. Those that come by train will take a taxi. You know, they're not going to have a car to drive to the Pocketbook Factory. So that's why we suggested the change.
Well, I agree with that, because if they don't have a car, then we don't have, that's not an imposition on the community. But I do think that it should be a condition that during the time of construction, that the workers are shuttled in and out. There's nothing wrong with that being a condition just for that period of time of construction, right?
Right. No, yeah. No, we suggested it.
Yeah, so we can make that. Yeah, I don't know that. Yeah, I just don't know that we had considered it being a condition, but I think it'd be fine if it is.
Great. I see no reason for the government to require someone to have a shuttle. You want to make your guests' experience a more luxurious and wonderful one, you make a shuttle for them. If you don't, then they schlep on their own terms. That's up to you.
And the only other language we had in five, it was similar to four.
Andy, let our lawyer guide us through five, and you can weigh in. Can you?
No.
Five. Okay, sorry, Andy. I'm very sorry. Sorry, Andy.
What Andy is referring to is that he requested that there be a sentence along the lines of this one.
That makes sense.
Such that, if they have off-site parking and they don't need a shuttle, then they wouldn't need to operate the shuttle.
Talking about for the workers?
Yeah, just during the construction phase. So if during construction we secured a space where we could park the construction workers, we wouldn't need the shuttle. If we don't secure that, we obviously do.
That's assuming that the spaces you secure are close enough that the construction workers could then just walk.
Right.
Where would that be, Andy? Where would that be?
Copy paste it down. In the event the applicant secures fixed parking spaces, comma, doesn't really matter how many.
I think Laura was asking where physically could there be those spaces.
Oh, yeah.
We are looking at potential spaces in close proximity to the Pocketbook Factory. Just down the street.
And that's not going to impose on another community or another neighborhood?
No.
How do you know? I mean, I'm just so curious.
No, because there's it's an open lot. I mean, we talked about that. There's a there's vacant city land across the street, farther down Washington Street. Okay. Yes. So if, you know, I mean, and it probably won't happen, but if it did, and we could have them park there during construction, you know, the same rule would apply.
Okay. Patrick, with apologies to Andy, could you take us through item number 6 now?
Sure. The applicant shall submit a sound attenuation plan to mitigate noise impacts from outdoor events and demonstrate compliance with the City of Hudson Noise Ordinance, the form and substance of which shall be approved by the engineer to the planning board. And then I added the following sentence based off of our discussion so far tonight. The project must comply with all applicable regulations of the City of Hudson Noise Ordinance. So the goal of this was to allow the project to get a conditional approval with the understanding that they're still going to submit a sound plan that is going to be reviewed by the planning board engineer to make sure that this plan is doing what it's supposed to do, which is mitigate those impacts and ensure that the project will comply with the code. And then as just a belt and suspenders type of move, I've added that they are required to comply with the applicable regulations, even though they would have been required to comply with those in any event.
I want to say that sound is part of my field, even though I don't completely understand it. And I think that it needs to be a sound engineer. I'm not comfortable with the engineer to the planning board. In other words, do we get to choose a sound engineer?
Yeah, I would say shall be approved by an acoustics engineer to be determined or to be selected by the planning board. And I wouldn't say a sound engineer because that's the guy behind the, you know, behind the board at a recording studio, right? I would say an acoustics engineer to be selected by the planning board, or an acoustics expert or an acoustics consultant. I don't think we need to decide right now who that's going to be. I mean, that might be Aaron or his firm, might be someone else. I think that the critical thing is that we, if we're able to, we give the applicant provisional approval, and then we work out the specifics of the sound attenuation, when they come back to the plan.
I think acoustics engineers is a good term, is the right term.
Aaron, I'm not an engineer. Can you please confirm for me whether or not acoustics engineer is like a term of art in the field?
It's a term I've heard used, but I think an acoustics consultant would be better terminology. You don't necessarily, experts in this field would not necessarily be professional engineers as defined by the state of New York, but would still have the expertise to weigh in on the subject.
There is a big field of acoustics engineering, so... So I'm looking this up, and again, this is just on my phone, and I'm not doing a deep search. And so I see the title here: acoustic engineers / consultants. So how about that? That covers everybody. Acoustics engineers / consultants.
Okay. To be selected by the planning board.
Yeah.
Patrick, you got that?
I do. Any other comment?
Board?
Yep. But I also would like to see, do we want to discuss, end times for during the week at least?
Or outside?
Yes.
Yeah, I agree. Where would we discuss that now? Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Because this is when we're doing the conditions, if somebody could go through what the code says about it, because I can't remember. Is it 10 o'clock?
10 to 7, I think, is the code rule.
I believe it was 10 p.m. to 7 a.m.
On Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
That's correct.
Oh. Laura, do you have a specific proposal for?
Well, you know, I would say for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you know, like 7 o'clock maybe. And then, and you know, just so that, and then Friday, Saturday, Sunday, you know, whatever the code says.
That sounds okay to me.
Remember, it's a residential area.
Oh. At least 95% of it is, yeah.
Can we be heard on that?
Of course. Mm-hmm. I mean, sorry, Larry, can you be heard on that?
Sure.
All right. I mean, what we would propose, there are regs in the code that talk about commercial music. And so what we would propose, I think we talked about that, would be on Friday and Saturday, the, you know, no noise, you know, after 11 until 7 a.m. and Sunday through Thursday, utilizing the code that says 10 p.m. So it would be no noise from 10 p.m. to 7 a.m. And again, all that noise still has to meet the requirements of the code, even during the times where it's allowed.
Yeah, but you know that the levels that the code allows, if you're trying to get to sleep because you have to get up to go to work in the morning, it's still loud, Andy. I mean, I think that 10 p.m. on a weekday is really not fair. Again, just remember, this is a residential area.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a residential zoning district. You know, I mean, that's the thing. And the zoning, you know, the zoning code does lay out the requirements for the districts. And we're not looking to go beyond that. We're willing to be in compliance with it. And we're willing to do the sound attenuation to mitigate it even more. You know, but, you know, to me, Sunday through Thursday at 10 p.m. is not that late. And for a Friday and Saturday night at 11 p.m., it's not that.
You know, I want to say, Andy, I understand what you're saying. That is what the area is zoned as. But we're kind of looking at it as that particular block, those two residential blocks that you're going to set your project on. So because of those blocks being a good 95% residential or 99%, I'm going to agree that the music should be cut off a little earlier during the weekdays and on the weekends. Now, I live on Worth, and I can't stand noise. I mean, at about 7, 8 o'clock at night, especially 10 o'clock at night, but 7 or 8, you can hear a pin drop here. Even though the trucks are coming, they just stop. So it does make a difference.
Yeah, but the concern we have is that, you know, then we're going to have a restriction that, you know, isn't in your code. I mean, you have a very detailed code.
But we can do that.
You do.
That's what we do.
But you've been our lawyer on this board, Andy. We that's what we can do. I mean, we have
shut down.
Okay. What I don't want to have, let's talk amongst yourselves. I don't want us to engage in a debate with the applicant's attorneys. We can determine on our own what we want to do. Gene, can you tell me, I mean, you have experience with, you know, noise violations and what it's like for people. I mean, what's your thoughts on this?
Well, it's restricted the applicant to running a business that he's entitled to. In years past, anytime we get the noise complaints, you know, we handled it accordingly. They put him on notice, and if it continued, then they were written up for it, either by the police or the building inspector's office. It's already in the code as to what you can and can't do, and by adding to it, you're circumventing the code, as far as I'm concerned.
Mark, what do you say?
I think that I appreciate Teresa's and Laura's comments. I think there's room to scale it back a bit. I don't think 7 is reasonable. I think 9 is reasonable. So perhaps splitting the difference. I do appreciate these guys. You know, they've got a business, they've got private property rights, they've got the code governing them. But I do think that as it's a commercial or a residential neighborhood,
9 o'clock during those weekdays seems fair to me.
Patrick, what's your experience here? I mean,
you forgot John.
Oh, John, sorry. What's your thoughts on this one?
I guess we could do it. My lean would be to go with the code, to be honest with you. Because I have a feeling that there aren't going to be a lot of wild parties there at 10 o'clock at night, or probably even at 9 o'clock at night. But, just my thought. I mean, I live in an area where I listen to the Basilica, and sometimes they're doing it till 10 o'clock at night when there are bands down there practicing and stuff like that. Stuff on the waterfront. You have a tendency to block those things out. You know, the problem would be with residential neighborhood kids who need to get to sleep at night before, you know, school day or something like that. That could cause a problem. So, I think based on what, you know, Andy and Sean have said, they're going to be pretty attentive to it. So, I'll go with an earlier time if everybody wants it, but I think, you know, the regular code hours would work for me.
Okay. Patrick.
Call Steve.
Patrick, in your experience, is it common for a planning board to set a condition that is more restrictive than the code when you have a commercial enterprise in a residential neighborhood like this one?
The planning board definitely can. I'll just remind the board that your guiding rule in all of this is that your conditions need to be reasonable to address the impacts of the use that might be harming the neighborhood. I will also point out that, you know, noise is always thorny, and it can be hard to define what is a nuisance, what's not. Even if we do establish that, you know, they can't have amplified music past a certain time, the fact that the code is allowing this means that literally anyone else in the neighborhood could still do that. So it's not guaranteeing that the neighborhood will be insulated from sources of noise. I also would point out that we don't want to, you know, interfere too much on what the code has established. Those are guidelines based on, you know, the Common Council doing a close review of what they feel is appropriate and necessary in certain areas. And people and applicants will purchase property with an expectation that these are the restrictions that they need to meet. In any case, I'm sorry, this is rambling. You certainly can limit hours of operation, especially for certain noise producing events. I would just remind the board to really limit its restriction as much as it can in order to address the impact here.
So if it was limited to 9 o'clock during the week, is less restrictive than, is that too restrictive? I mean, reminding everybody that this is a residential area where, as somebody pointed out, you know, children have to go to bed and get up in the morning at whatever time children get up. And that an organization that plans to be good neighbors.
I would probably ask the applicant, based on your business model and plans of operation, would a 9 o'clock restriction severely hamper you?
Sunday to Thursday.
Yes.
So there's plans to have a lot of noise till 10 o'clock during the week, amplified noise outside during the week.
I'll chime in. You know, I think it's as we've been consistent all along that you know, we are not planning on having a loud outdoor events venue. That isn't our business, but we feel that, you know, just being treated the same as everyone else in the code and just kind of following what our government has set out is what we would feel most comfortable sticking to. I definitely appreciate the perspective Laura and Teresa and that everyone has shared, but yeah, I think that's sort of where we're at.
This is only going to include that public space, right? The outside area that can be used for the
exterior amplified noise. You know, I think the proposal, if I understand Laura, is to restrict exterior amplified noise to hours to must end at 9 p.m. on Sunday to Thursday. Is that what I'm understanding?
You're kind of cracking up, Larry, but I think that's what I'm saying.
And I'm sorry, just to be clear, what we're seeking would be the code provisions of Sunday through Thursday, 10 p.m., Friday and Saturday evenings, 11 p.m.
Okay, board, what do you want to do?
I think you vote on it, right?
All right, Laura, can you set out what you want to, with the wording for what you want to do?
Well, I mean, I'm not making a motion,
But are you suggesting that we do?
I'm suggesting that that from Sunday through Thursday, I'll change it, my idea to 9, to provide for children to be able to go to bed and get up in the morning to go to school. And it is a neighborhood. I just want to remind everybody. And then, of course, for Saturday, Friday and Saturday, the 11 that's already allowed. That's what I'm proposing.
Okay, let's take a vote. Clark, what do you say, yes or no?
Yes, that seems fair to me, I agree.
Okay, John?
It would work for me.
Teresa?
Yes, I agree.
Laura?
She already voted.
I agree with
that. Jean?
No, stick with the city code.
Larry?
I don't like restrictions on businesses. I'm going to say no because yes wins. So it's 4-2 and we restrict it at 9 o'clock.
Okay.
Patrick, did you get that?
Yes. So the condition that you'd be proposing is something along the lines of exterior amplified noise.
Yeah, exactly. Exterior amplified.
Not be permitted after.
This would also cover that it's the part that's being used as public space, because you'll put a sign that no noise, you know, right? In other words, the area that's being used for public, you'll also probably put a sign there that tells, you know, no amplified music out, no amplified noise after 9 between these hours.
I think the public is not there. I think that the public, right, Sean, it's the public access ends at a certain hour, right?
Well, that depends on the declaration of easement. Can we go back up to that one?
Sure. So the original point of contention, I do understand where Andy is coming from, especially being concerned about a right that does run with the land even after the property is sold. However, we do want to ensure that if, you know, this applicant decides to sell his business to someone else, that the planning board can still enforce these provisions against that subsequent owner-operator of the business. So an in-between might be something along the lines of changing the phrase declaration of easement to written instrument. That way we do have a instrument other than just a sentence or two in the resolution that more clearly establishes what public space we're talking about and what is being offered. And that also grants a little bit more leeway for Andy and my office to try to come up with something, whether or not be a license or temporary easement or something along those lines, that still will ensure that there is this public access space, but it would hopefully alleviate some of the owner's concerns.
Well, I appreciate the sort of Solomonic suggestion. Who vets and gives a thumbs up, thumbs down to this so-called written instrument?
As drafted, it would be my office.
Right. I mean, you'll draft it, but then who's to say that you didn't, sell the company store or get a bad deal or blindsided or coerced or worse? I mean, how do we ensure that the public's being protected here? I mean, I like the notion of a written instrument. It's less burdensome than an easement, but how do we know, whether it comes back to us or the Common Council? I mean, is there some public body that can see this thing to be sure that it's the intention here?
I wanted to say, sorry, Patrick, I'm just going to interrupt. I think that temporary easement is maybe a good phrase to explore. And in reference to what Larry's talking
Laura,
you've muted yourself.
I don't know how I did that. Okay. What did you hear? So I think about that term temporary easement, because that might work, but you'd work that out with Andy. But is there a way that whatever it is that you and Andy work out, your office and Andy works out, it could come back to us for approval?
We could try to arrange something like that, but at that point, I don't think it would be worth having a conditional resolution that got adopted tonight. I think it might be more beneficial for Andy and my office to consult in between this meeting and the next meeting, try to get that ironed out, because it would just be coming back to the planning board anyway.
Well, then could I make a proposal, Larry, that that's what happens, and then at our next meeting on the 18th, a special meeting, hopefully we've seen everything before that meeting, whatever Andy and Patrick's office works out, and all we have to do is a simple vote.
To confirm, do you mean November 18th?
Yes, we have a special session scheduled for November 18th.
Okay. Andy, I'm sure you have thoughts.
But before we do that, thank you, Patrick, let's not do that yet. Okay. So board, I think the suggestion here is to allow the applicant and the planning board's counsel to develop the terms of this so-called written instrument, whether it's temporary easement or some sort of agreement, and bring that back to us at the special session that we have scheduled for next Thursday, the 18th. Are we in support of that? I mean, I don't mind doing that. I mean, Steve's going to chair that meeting, thank heavens. I just would not want us to have to review the conditions all over again, right? I mean,
no, it would just be for this one, and also, hopefully, we will have seen it before that meeting, so that anything that we wanted to add or question is done prior to the meeting. So we're really not taking up time at that meeting on this application that we right, guys? I mean.
Right. Patrick, can your office do that? I mean, it can't come to us at, 3 p.m. on Thursday.
Yeah. Okay. I want to just clarify one thing. So the board wouldn't be making up its mind on the instrument in between this time. We would still have to look at it at that meeting and see if that's what we wanted to approve.
We wouldn't vote on it, but we can look at it.
No, I'm just clarifying the record.
I'm sorry.
So in terms of getting it done with a little over a week turnaround, I think I would ask Andy if this is something that he thinks we can try to put together. Andy, you're muted. Sorry, I didn't mean to hand it off to Andy before you were done.
All I was going to say was, we would be in agreement with the written instrument. The one thought I had, knowing that the board is busy, you do have your attorney. He is representing your interests. To the extent we were able to reach an agreement between Patrick and myself, and he individually shares that with you board members and gets your approval, ultimately he's going to have your approval or not. And I trust he's not going to prove something if you all tell him not, so that we essentially can do the same thing without you having to bring us back and us having to come. And you also can assure yourself that you've each individually reviewed it privately with your attorney and approved it.
But if there's concerns, Andy, wouldn't you want to be there to hash out concerns if the board raises issues relative to, you know, us reviewing it in advance or live next?
I just think we can certainly do that. But my thought is that, you know, ultimately, you know, your attorney's representing you.
Right.
We do have, we're willing to enter into that written agreement. I think we've demonstrated we're willing to put in, you know, terms that are clear and fair and recognize what the spirit of the discussion has been. Certainly if we couldn't reach that agreement, that could be an issue, but I just don't see that being a problem. And I think you can all have independent input with your attorney and we can get this done. That's just my thought.
Yeah. I think I like Patrick's suggestion. Let Patrick, why don't you and Andy work on whatever the terms of this written instrument is. You forward it to the board. We have chance to look at it, and we ultimately clarify the wording of this final condition and are in a position to vote up or down on the entirety of the resolution to approve at our special session next week.
Okay.
Board, are we in agreement with that?
Sounds good.
Sure. Yes.
Okay. Then at that point, we are very close, but we didn't quite cross the goal line. I've been watching football when I work lately, so excuse the football reference. All right, I gotta find the agenda now. Okay, thank you, applicants and public. That was over an hour and a half. I think that was necessary, and I appreciate everyone's forbearance. That's an important project for the city in a range of ways, and I think that we're doing our best to make sure that we honor the applicant's interest, but also protect the public's interest. Right, our next public hearing is a public.
Larry, before you start, we should probably do a motion to continue the public hearing on the Pocketbook Factory.
Well, we closed the public hearing, right?
Okay. All right.
Close it.
Patrick, do we need any? We're about to lose you, regardless, right? So, do we need to do anything?
At this point, I don't think we need to have the public hearing open.
Okay.
We have a pretty good idea of what we're going to do moving forward, and I don't think that's really going to change. I don't think we're getting new materials or anything.
Right. But in terms of moving on to the next agenda item, is there any motion to conclude our discussion on this project this evening and move on to the next one?
No, you can just move on to your next application. You've already moved to close the public hearing.
Okay. Well, thank you, Patrick, this evening. Sean, Andy, if Andy's still here, thank you so much for your patience. I think we made some progress.
Great.
All right. Our next public hearing, and thanks, John, too, for keeping me relatively on track.
Larry, actually, sorry to interrupt. Did you need me for 26 Warren or no?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry, but we do.
No, I just wanted to confirm.
Okay. Coffee break, I suppose.
Yeah.
All right. So our next public. Do you think Patrick is suggesting that we bump 26 Warren forward?
I agree.
Patrick, are you suggesting that we revise the agenda to push you forward so that you actually can go back to your family?
Not just that, but to make sure that we're you know, conserving resources.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I like that. Okay, board, with your approval, I will move to item C and do the continuation of our public hearing for 26 Warren Street, which is a site plan approval for change of occupancy from R3 to R1, changing the use from a single family residence being used as a bed and breakfast to a hotel. The property is in the central commercial zoning district and is a permitted use. We all got a memo from Patrick's office, and I think before we ask for any commentary or updates from the applicant, Patrick, maybe you could just update the board on the memo, and you might want to do a screen share and show us what you've got.
If you don't mind, I'm going to refrain from sharing the memo because it is confidential uh-huh. communications between us.
Okay.
Giving you legal advice. However, I will address a general issue that's been brought to our office's attention, which is that this is a pretty unique project, and it's not your typical type of hotel. And from what we understand, some members of the planning board were unsure of how well this fell within the definition of hotel. And I wanted to just state that if the planning board wants further clarity on that, there is an avenue set forth in your code that allows you to directly request an interpretation of the zoning law by the Zoning Board of Appeals, because they're tasked of being the ultimate arbiters of what is and is not a hotel, among other things. So you could certainly do that. They would have to schedule a public hearing and ultimately get back to you.
But my understanding is that the definition of a hotel is fairly clear, right? If people are sleeping there,
the definition is
profit off their sleeping there, then it's a hotel.
Yeah.
If they're sleeping there, it could be a B&B.
Which is also a hotel by our code, isn't it, Patrick?
It is. A hotel is defined under your zoning law as a dwelling, parens, including a bed and breakfast offered for rent, the gross receipts derived from its operation of which are subject to the payment of a sales tax by the state of New York. So basically, if a dwelling is rented and you need to pay taxes on that revenue, it's a hotel.
But then we have other restrictions on a B&B that we don't have on a hotel.
Yes, that's the definition.
So where does the division comes? Whereas if it's the same definition, then where does that division come to apply the restrictions that we have on a B&B? Are those restrictions also to be applied on what is considered now a hotel?
No, not necessarily. It's that you have a broad use that have more narrow uses within it that are subject to different regulations than anything else. So for example, you could have a definition for dwelling, or I'm just making this up. I'm not saying that this is your code. You could have a definition of dwelling, and then you also have a definition for two family dwelling and for three family dwelling. And each of those different subsets could be subject to different regulations.
Okay. So we have the definition of the dwelling of a hotel in our code? That separates
it from a B&B. I'd have to double check whether or not there's a definition for bed and breakfast. It does not look like there is.
What are the restrictions? Teresa, can you repeat that? What are the higher restrictions on a B&B?
They had thrown it under short-term rentals where you have to... I think it's 2 months out of a year you can do it, turn your home or whatever into a B&B. And if you want to do it all the times, 24/7, 12 months out of a year, you have to live on the premises.
There was an Airbnb law. Is that applies to
B&B? I mean, did they separate Airbnb from B&B? I don't know. I can't remember if they did that.
So,
I'm just trying to find out what is, you know, this 8-room dwelling could be a 4-bedroom house, single family house that took their double parlor, kitchen, and dining room and turned it into an 8-room hotel.
I don't know. I only just received this right before the meeting. I had written a note to Craig Haig asking for some kind of clarification. So he did write myself and Victoria. I had CC'd to her back. So I don't know if this is helpful, guys, but I'll read it. And I have to actually use a thing because the print is so small. That's not Craig's fault. That's my printer's fault. Hi, Laura. As per New York State code, hotels are residential structures that provide sleeping areas where the occupants are transient in nature and not limited to inns and motels. B&Bs are single family residence owner occupied and one meal a day is issued. Inns can be considered B&Bs as well. Airbnb is not a use identified in the building code. That is a business where owners of residential structures dwellings used for short-term rentals where the occupants are transient. Transient is where the occupants are fewer than 30 days. Does any of this make sense? I hope it does, at least to Patrick.
Laura, can you read the hotel thing again? It was going in and out. The part that you get for the hotel.
All I said is that as per New York State code, hotels are residential structures that provide sleeping areas where the occupants are transient in nature and not limited to inns and motels. There's nothing in the code that indicates that the owner has to live on the premises for a hotel. B&Bs are single family residence owner occupied and one meal a day is issued. Inns can be considered B&Bs as well. And then there's a whole other thing for Airbnbs.
So, Patrick?
Yes.
Given that this applicant doesn't fall neatly into one of those categories,